Nemoto presents filmmaking giants. Federico Fellini, the dreamer of the screen. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Christopher voice. Running time, approximately 19 minutes. Federico Fellini. Hello and welcome back to Filmmaking Giants Who Changed How We See the World. We have traveled with masters who tightened film's grammar until it could carry history and with poets who slowed time until a single breath sounded like truth. Today we enter a studio that looks like a small city under a roof, where streets are invented and skies are painted, where a director walks with a sketchpad in his pocket and a circus in his head, and where reality is treated not as a limit but as clay. Our guide is Federico Fellini, caricaturist turned filmmaker, ringmaster of Cinecittà, a man who discovered that memory could be built like a set and that a set, if lovingly lit, could be more honest than the streets that inspired it. He is the director who made Fellini-esque, a word that both flatters and misleads, a director who gave us the parade as philosophy, the confessional as spectacle, and the most forgiving circle in cinema. He was born by the Adriatic in Rimini in 1920, where wind from the sea pushes fog over streets that can seem to belong more to a dream than to a map. Catholic bells and carnival barkers taught him early how authority and spectacle share the same throat. He drew faces in school margins and at a newsstand and in a traveling caricature booth, learning that a nose exaggerated without malice can reveal a whole life more kindly than a precise portrait delivered without love. Rome pulled him as Rome pulls many, the promise that if you arrive with a pencil and nerve, the city will supply characters faster than you can sketch them. He found work at Marco Aurelio, a satirical magazine that trained his eye to accept clutter and contradiction as material, not mess. Radio paid some bills. Voice acting taught him that a voice can carry a lie flawlessly or sing a truth that a face is too tired to admit. He met Giulietta Messina, actress, clown, saint of the rueful smile, and married her. Their partnership became a grammar. He worked as a scriptwriter with Rossellini and others while neorealism remade Italian cinema. Cameras outdoors, faces from streets, doubt about authority treated as hygiene. Fellini inhaled the air but in it smelled something of his own, a freedom to let reality be the seed rather than the tree. The first features arrive like field notes from a world finding its balance. Variety Lights, co-directed with Alberto Lattawada, follows a small troupe of performers who learn that applause is a currency that can bankrupt an honest heart. The White Sheik tumbles a honeymooning couple into the fantasy factory of photoromanzi, those popular photo novels whose heroes promised melodramatic deliverance. The film looks light but it already contains the Fellini habit of treating delusion with tenderness. Then I Vitaloni, a seaside town, a group of men stuck between boyhood and the dignity of leaving, jokes that curdle at dawn, mothers who forgive before sons ask, a local parade that feels like a town's biography written in brass. The film is affectionate and unsparing. It understands the humiliation small places inflict and the protections they offer. It gives us a prototype for the Fellini man at a crossroads, bored by good advice, overmatched by duty, allergic to finality, in love with exits he never quite reaches. He built his own inner theater with La Strada, a road story that becomes theology without turning pious. Gelsomina, played by Messina, is sold by her mother to Zampano, a strong man who breaks chains around his chest and bruises anything he does not understand. They travel from fair to fair, joined for a time by the fool, a tightrope walker and clown who refuses to treat insignificance as an insult. The plot can be retold in a handful of lines. The feeling cannot. Nino Rota's music finds the bruise and turns it into a melody you don't so much hum as carry. Fellini gives Messina a face that reads like an icon and refuses to let Zampano's violence become an interesting vice. When the film ends, late, on a beach where nothing has changed and everything has, the director trusts silence to be a sentence. He has discovered that compassion can be staged without sermon, and that the camera can forgive without excusing. The Knights of Cabiria returns Messina to the street, this time as a Roman sex worker who keeps being promised rescue by men who are experts in pretending to love. Cabiria is not naive, she is brave enough to try again. Fellini follows her with a patience that is itself a form of respect. We watch her make money, lose it, make it again. We watch her try on gentility and reject it as another costume. We watch her hope modulate from a shout to a murmur. Rome around her is a laboratory of hustles and devotions. Show business and saints' day processions, lottery tickets and faux miracles, a hypnotist stage where a crowd's appetite learns how to borrow intimacy. The ending, Kabiria walking, mascara ruined, surrounded by a group of young musicians who refuse to let her be alone with her defeat, contains the generosity that will govern Fellini's best work. Life will not be improved by a speech, it will be improved by a tune and a decision not to look away. Then La Dolce Vita, the film that changed dictionaries, the word paparazzo, entering many languages because he blessed a character with it, and changed what a film could do with a city. It is an opera in nights, seven of them, plus a dawn, a tour of Rome's glamour and rot with a journalist, Marcello, as your politely exhausted guide. The episodes are built like rooms in a palace of appetite, a nightclub where the band never flags, a party where conversation dies, a rumor of a miracle pursued by crowds who want the light more than they want the truth, a modernist apartment where marriage becomes a geometry with sharp edges, a fountain that baptizes nothing and delights everyone, a friend named Steiner whose cultured calm hides a despair that Fellini films without ornament. Otello Martelli's cinematography composes Rome as chiaroscuro you can walk. Piero Gherardi's production design teaches concrete to flirt. Rota's score threads debauch with tenderness. The film does not scold, it takes attendance. When the monstrous fish is dragged in at the shore, its eye glassy, its mouth open and mute, Marcello and his friends stare at it as if God had spoken and then fall back into jokes. The dawn that follows gives the film its conscience. A girl on the other side of the water calls to Marcello, but the wind steals the sentence and he smiles and shrugs. The film ends not in punishment but in a failure to hear. Fellini has found a way to indict modernity without pretending he stands outside it. If La Dolce Vita is an anatomy of public life, 8.5 is the anatomy of a mind that has made too many promises. A director named Guido, played by Marcello Mastroianni, has promised a science fiction spectacular that will redeem a career and a studio's finances. He is also trying to juggle marriage and mistress, friends and sycophants, memory and lust, Catholic shame and pagan appetite. The movie he is supposed to make refuses to organize itself. The movie we are watching refuses to be obedient to the rules that once stabilized narrative. Johnny D. Venanzo's camera moves like thought. A writer's conference becomes a dance. A harem of memory arranges itself into an impossible domestic piece that collapses on cue. A rocket gantry rises like a cathedral to vanity. A critic arrives to pronounce diagnoses that the film cheerfully disobeys. And Asa Nisi Masa, a nonsense phrase from childhood, becomes a key that doesn't unlock a door so much as remind us that doors can be invented. Again Rota composes the world's heartbeat. Again Gherardi builds rooms where weather can change without a cloud. At the end, when Guido gathers everyone in a circle, a circus ring that forgives him for being human and asks him to keep working, you understand the Fellini ethic. Art is not a confession of mastery, it is a rehearsal for honesty. The final parade is not triumph but acceptance. If you have ever needed to continue without knowing, 8.5 lends you courage. Color arrives like a permission slip. Juliet of the Spirits turns the camera toward the woman who has been enduring a man's fantasies. Giulietta Messina plays a middle-aged wife who suspects her husband's affair and discovers that her house contains trapdoors into worlds she has been trained not to enter. The colors are not decor, they are truth instruments. Red for appetite, white for denial, blue for a sadness that pretends to be serenity. Neighbors and gurus and grifters arrive with a carnival's assurance that they are gifts. Fellini stages visions without apology and lets the film's heart stay with the woman learning to draw the boundaries she was not taught as a girl. His reputation for loving women as images has sometimes shadowed the fact that he built some of the cinema's most enduring rooms for women's interior life. Juliet is one of them, a house transformed into a psyche, gently lit. When the 60s turned brutal and glittering at once, he dove into the mythic with Fellini's Satyricon, borrowing Petronius's fragments to build an epic of appetite. Danilo Donati's designs construct a Rome both tactile and abstract, a report from antiquity that looks like the future's memory of us. The episodes do not connect as plots so much as accumulate like a fresco's vignettes, feasts that treat bodies as tableware, riddles whose answers are cruelty, lovers who change masks because faces are insufficient, a landscape of temples so persuasive you might kneel just to rest. The film scandalized some and converted others. It still refuses to flatter us. Decadence here is not a sin to be punished. It is an anthropology to be understood. He turned toward memory as a city you could walk. The Clowns, made for television, his love letter and elegy, a visit to the men and women who once taught him that shame, timed correctly, can heal. He films retirement with courtesy and tents with faces. Roma maps the capital as a weather system of traffic and talk, trattoria nights and ecclesiastical fashion shows, catacombs and construction sites, brothels and roadside apartments, all arranged without apology into a collage whose logic is belonging. Fellini's Roma is not a documentary, it is a citizenship test. If you love the city enough to let it contradict itself, you pass. Amar Khoud returns to Rimini and gives a town its adolescence back. Fascism appears not as an argument but as an atmosphere. Rituals, uniforms, a motorcade that interrupts a child's joke, neighbors turning into a crowd because crowds are easier than consciences. We meet Gradisca, lit like a torch, Titta and his friends, libidinous and loyal, a mad uncle who climbs a tree and refuses to come down until someone promises him a big woman, a fog so thick it turns a street into a stage for lost souls calling one another by name. Giuseppe Rotuno's images are so tender that cynicism shrinks. Rota's music remembers before we do. The film laughs without cruelty, grieves without self-pity, and leaves you with a town that has invented a way to outlast its quickly passing tyrants, telling the truth about how ridiculous we are and how much we need each other. Fellini's late work keeps experimenting. City of Women turns a dream into a conference where a man is asked to examine the laziness of his desires. The film argues with itself and sometimes loses, which is another kind of honesty. And The Ship Sails On is an opera buffa for Europe on the cusp of catastrophe, a funeral voyage that becomes a moral inventory. Ginger and Fred reunites Messina with Mastroianni as aging impersonators of Rogers and Astaire, invited to perform on a vulgar television pageant. They dance anyway with a grace full of sorrow and humor. Intervista stages its own making. A director remembers arriving at Cinecittà as a young man, returns now as an old one, and the studio obliges by becoming a memory palace. Fellini's Casanova is a glittering coffin for a seducer who discovers that machinery can counterfeit intimacy. Donato's costumes make desire look like ceremony. Rotuno's lens forgives nothing. Late, the voice of the moon listens to a fool under night skies that still permit a secret. The workshop behind the wonder is as instructive as the films. Fellini wrote with Tullio Pinelli and Ennio Flaiano, moving lines around until the argument inside a scene sharpened and then leaving space on set for the better accident. He cast faces from streets, hospitals, bars, and cab ranks, men with noses corrected by life, women whose laughter could survive costumes. He worked in Italy's post-synchronization tradition, dubbing voices later so that he could treat the set like a playground for rhythm. Camera first, movement second, words last. He used hidden earpieces to feed lines so that rhythm stayed musical. He asked actors to trust shape more than text, and their relief often registers on screen as authenticity. He kept a dream journal, sketched constantly, and treated his drawings as blueprints for scenes. He collaborated with cinematographers Otello Martelli, Gianni Di Venanzo, Giuseppe Rotuno, who understood that illumination can be moral, with designers Piero Gherardi, Danilo Donati, who taught walls to speak, with Nino Rota, whose melodies became the bloodstream of his films. The studio did not make his work artificial, it made it legible. He was criticized, often with love, sometimes with irritation. Baroque, people said, self-indulgent, in love with spectacle. He heard it. He answered by keeping the camera on faces when they were not prepared, by ending parades with quiet, by letting the cruel reveal themselves without editorializing. He did not believe that grimness is the only form of honesty. He believed that the ridiculous, treated with respect, can educate the heart faster than lectures. He did not hide his blind spots. His men can be slow to learn. His women are sometimes asked to carry too much grace. Yet within those limits, he built rooms where kindness could be felt as weather. He tried, again and again, to arrange forgiveness without forgetting harm. What do we take from him that travels outside the studio gates? Begin with the parade, not as bombast but as method. A parade is serialized complexity. It is the management of difference without erasing it. In a company's year, you can stage parades that dignify every team's craft. Not slide decks, but living demonstrations where people walk their work past their neighbors. You can let the workplace see itself as an ensemble and discover pride that budgets cannot buy. Fellini's sets were communities. His parades were rehearsals for moral imagination. Add the principle of confess spectacle. Hide the strings and you might seduce. Show them and you might teach. In communications, in classrooms, in hospitals, in politics, we owe people the courtesy of explaining how attention is being arranged. A boardroom that admits its theater keeps its ethics. A campaign that reveals its cuts trains citizens instead of amusing them. Fellini never denied that he loved show. He insisted that the show serve truth. Add the discipline of making memory usable. He built a marcord and Roma from recollection and rumor, but he did not confuse emotion with accuracy. He treated memory like a collaborator who is always late but usually right. In our own lives and institutions, we can do the same. Keep chronicles, draw what scares us, invite the older voices to walk the corridor and tell us where the floor creaks. Build rooms that let experience circulate without becoming nostalgia. The point is not to dwell, it is to orient. Add the practice of turning appetite into service. Fellini did not exorcise vanity, he put it to work. He found ways for his craving for attention to fund generosity. Circles that include everyone, finales that send the camera toward the faces who have done the real work, bows that build community. We can imitate him by turning our most compromising energies into fuel for someone else's joy, a marketing department that spends its genius on the unglamorous product that actually saves lives, a leader who uses their talent for being seen to point at the person who has earned the credit, a teacher who knows how to parade their students more beautifully than they parade themselves. Finally, borrow his capacity to apologize in the language you actually speak. Fellini's language was spectacle. His apologies are spectacles with the eye shrunk to a node in a circle. Yours may be memos, budgets, policies, dinners, rides to the clinic, returned calls. Whatever the form, apologize in it. Arrange your resources so that someone else's burden becomes lighter because you understand the choreography of your own power. He did not pretend to have solved the problem of desire versus duty. He made films that include his failures because he knew the failures were ordinary and therefore useful. He did not apologize with speeches. He apologized with shots in which sinners do something decent without needing to become saints. The skeptic in you can object that he sometimes used women as vessels for his guilt. The skeptic is right. The other truth is that he granted women some of the cinema's most durable mercies. Messina's Gelsomina and Cabiria, Anouk Aimée's Maddalena, Claudia Cardinale's Angel on the Beach in La Dolce Vita, Sandra Milo's Self-Possession in 8½, the unnamed girls who appear with music in a marcord and remind a town that joy needs witnesses. He died in 1993, a day after celebrating 50 years of marriage to Messina, who would follow him months later. By then the images had entered our muscles. A fountain that makes night kind, a beach that makes silence honest, a circle that makes confusion bearable, a town where fog turns cruelty into a mistake we might stop repeating. The word Fellini-esque, so often misused to excuse clutter without conscience, can be rescued by remembering what he actually built. Processions that dignify strangers, festivals that test egos, confessions that become community. Watch the movies again and the word will blush back into accuracy. He changed how we see the world by letting the world be a studio for souls and a street for truths that would die indoors. He let us dress our memories in lights and then insisted we listen when the lights made us too proud. He recognized that spectacle can be a shield or a window and taught us to prefer the window. He gave us permission to make our apologies as performances that benefit others. He taught us to follow music to where duty and joy shake hands. He invited us, at the end of nights too long and years too hurried, to gather in a ring and keep the work going, not because it will perfect us, but because it will let us be human together a little longer. Thank you for listening to this episode of Filmmaking Giants Who Changed How We See the World.